ramparts of a tremendous hole. There's no use fighting it. Those parts ought to work together, right? To conquer ignorance and prejudice and hate with knowledge and sincerity.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a special introductory episode of the Curb interview / review / discussion culture piece podcast. My name is Andrew Pearce, and I'm coming from Boorloo, Western Australia, which is Noongar country. And I'm joined by my good friend and writing colleague and critique and co-chair of AFCA and everybody all things, Nadine Whitney. So thank you very much for joining me to discuss some films.
Thank you for having me, Andrew. And I am currently in Naam on the lands of the Kulin Nation. Sovereignty was never ceded.
I guess we should probably start just by giving a very, very quick rundown of what these kinds of shows might be like. We'll do them throughout the year, possibly, just having a quick conversation about some of the films that we might have written about or that we don't particularly have the time to write about but still want to mention or talk about. And the best way of doing that is sitting here and discussing it with each other, or there might be films that I see that I want to tell you about, or the films that you've seen that you want to tell me about, and we can just have a bit of a chat and a conversation. And the intention is for these to run for about half an hour, so just very kind of off-the-cuff discussions about some of the latest films that are in cinema. And then at the end, we'll also give you a recommendation for an older film, so something before, say, the 2010s, there about something that people don't talk about really all that much anymore and should see. It might be tangentially related to the films that we discussed. It might just be a random recommendation of something that we feel that people should seek out. So I guess we should probably talk about the films that we're here to talk about, which is we've got a few films which are late awards-friendly films that are arriving throughout the year. I think they're already out and released in America, but in Australia they're slowly coming about in January. And we'll be discussing Queer, Baby Girl and The Room Next Door. So, Nadine, I know that you are a little bit more familiar with the text of Queer than I am. Do you want to start talking about what that particular film is about?
Okay. Well, as you know, it's Luca Guadagnino, and he's titled it in some places William Burroughs as Queer or just Queer. Queer is an unfinished novel by Burroughs that wasn't published until much, 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 much later in his life. It came after his first piece, which was Junkie, and it talks about his homosexuality and his love affair, if you can call it that, his desperate need for a character based on somebody in his own life, Albert Louis Marker, who in this film is known as Eugene Allerton, and he's played by Drew Starkey. William Lee, who is William Burroughs, and you'll find in a lot of William Burroughs' work, there is a character called William Lee because his name is William Lee Burroughs, and he's the stand-in, and he's played by an excellent, excellent Daniel Craig. Also in the cast, we have Jason Schwartzman playing a version of Allen Ginsberg called Joe, and Leslie Manville playing an American doctor who's the captain to Ecuador called Dr. Cotta, and she's experimenting with a particular plant that allows hallucinations, and she's married to Mr. Cotta, who is the director. I just found this lovely director of Eureka, His name is Alessandro, I think.
Yeah, Lissandro Alessandro. Alonso.
Alessandro.
Yes.
Alonso, sorry. yes. And he hangs out with a sloth mostly, which I think is a very cool thing to do. And that was a real sloth.
Yes.
So they got to hang out with a sloth. Which
it's the peak moment of the film.
it was the peak moment of the film for me, because that was the real sloth. Okay, so for me, I know a lot about William Burroughs. I know about him biographically. I've read most of his work. And so I can't unknow about Burroughs when I watch Queer. So I've not been able to put myself into the position of watching it without knowing about the William Tell death of Joan, his wife, the fact that he was running from a drug conviction, he was also kind of running from being convicted or in absentia for Joan's murder, it was manslaughter he got, and that Joan and Drew Starkey's character, which is not mentioned in the film, were actually lovers as well. So there was this threesome, and that he had a child with Joan, which is a little, if you notice in one of the kind of dream sequences, there's a little fetus.
Right, yes.
Yeah. So there are all these visual cues in the film to Burroughs' biography, and that's where I just wasn't sure how much pre-existing knowledge you needed to have about Burroughs to find the work accessible. Mm. Now, you don't have that knowledge, Andrew. Can you tell me a bit how you felt about it?
Yeah, and part of the reason why I don't have that knowledge is because I tried a long, long time ago, just like a lot of people growing up, to read some William Burroughs, and I think I probably came at it at the wrong time, around the time that, you know, I was discovering the work of Cronenberg, and then went, oh, what's this book, Naked Lunch, and stuff like that, and then you read it as a teenager, and you're like, I don't understand this whatsoever, and I bounced off his work, and so I've never returned to it, and I've never really felt the need or desire to return to it, because there hasn't been a warmth to his work that I've resonated with. And so encountering Queer, I love Luca Guadagnino's work. I think that he's one of the more visually, and I guess I know some people have talked about his work being very textual in the way that it smells as well, so you can almost smell the film, and there is a certain aspect to Queer that you can actually almost smell and feel like you're in the world there as well with it. So entering this particular film, I was interested because of that exact experiment, not knowing Burroughs' work all that well. How would I resonate with it? What would I find that works with it? And from my understanding, it is very distinctly in the tone of what he writes like. And maybe that's why I can only really admire the work that's here, and the artificiality that is created here. A lot of it is shot on sound stages. I think it's all actually shot on sound stages, which gives this illusion of Mexico, give this illusion of South America and different aspects of that world, but it doesn't feel real. It's not tangible in the sense that it is a living, breathing place. It's fake. And that artificiality feels quite fascinating, but I'm not sure if that's part of the text or not. I've always found the notion of what we as audiences bring to a film before we actually watch it. Is it the film's duty to basically tell you everything that it's about within the film itself? Or is there a duty for the audience member to come to the film having pre-built knowledge, having an understanding of what the story is about too? And I know that there used to be this movement of film critics who loved going to go and see a film with only knowing that it was a title of a film. So this movie's called Queer. I'm just going to sit down and let it wash over me, going in with a minimal knowledge about the film before actually watching it, and then just experiencing it that way. And I guess, I mean, in this information heavy world that we live in, it's easier to do that because we don't all have the time to sit there and read up on the history of people or read the books that the film is based on or all these different kinds of things or get an understanding of the political movements that are going on around the world. So a lot of us are forced to sit there and watch a film without that pre-built knowledge. But does that make it a good experience? Does it make it a worthwhile experience? And, you know, I think that Queer is a film that I might return to in a few years' time and appreciate more when I've allowed it to kind of simmer in my mind, in the recesses of my mind, unlike a film like Challengers, which is so immediate and in your face and tells you exactly what it is right from the get-go. And you know exactly what you're getting at the end of that film, whereas Queer, you're still sitting there going, well, this is a very, it's forcing you to think. It's forcing you to engage with the film on the level that it needs to be engaged with. And a lot of that comes from the script, the adaptation, written by Justin Koritzkis, who did, obviously, Challengers too. And again, that's a very, very obvious script. But you mentioned Daniel Craig, who is phenomenal here, and how he manages to really imbue something quite dark. And this really reminds me of a lot of his earlier work, which I, you know, have yearned for him to return to the style of work that he did back in the early 2000s, like The Mother and Enduring Love, those kinds of films, which are really quite textually dark, but also give him something to build on as a genuine character to create. And he does that here. He's well informed about what the text is about, and that allows somebody like me to engage with it on the level of going, well, here is a great performer giving a great performance. I don't entirely get it, but that's okay. Does that kind of make sense? Is that something that you think that we as critics should do? Yeah,
it absolutely does make sense. And I mean, this is certainly not Daniel's first time playing a queer man. He was in Love is the Devil playing the painter Francis Bacon's lover, so Derek Jacobi's lover.
And so he's also married to Hugh Grant in Glass Onion as well.
That's right. And he's also, like, probably married to Rachel Weisz, who has played a queer woman in Disobedience. So we've got this Venn diagram. I don't think it is my duty as a critic to have read every piece of source material, because that's impossible. It just happens that I have read this one and know about William Burroughs and he's a dark, very dark character, but human being. As what you said about the soundstage is incorrect, in terms of, yes, Mexico is made up of a soundstage, but once we get to the jungles, that is actually in the jungle. So we go outside. I think that in a lot of ways, with the exception of a couple of scenes, it's one of Luca's less attractive looking films. I enjoy the memory box aspect of it, you know, the red hallways and William Lee looking in on his own life, for example. And I certainly enjoyed, you know, some of the effects of William trying to connect with Allerton, like he goes out of his body to do that when they're watching, for example, Orpheus, which is an absolutely a deliberate choice too, because you've got, you know, Jean-Marie Cocteau's lover playing Orpheus in the film. But I, again, there are aspects I completely enjoyed. There were some of the visuals, the way that he set up information about William B. that was great. The title sequence is brilliant. It actually tells you probably more about William Lee than anything else in the film. The fact that he loved guns, that he's a junkie, that he's half a writer but not quite a writer, that he's already somewhat in the interzone, which is where a lot of his work gets set. So Naked Lunch is in the interzone, which is essentially Tangier. You know, Luca does all these small things to let you know that this is happening. You know, the television is going off, and William Lee is fuzzy within it. You know that he's not quite there. But without Daniel's completely sweaty, committed, desperate, sad performance, I think the whole film would collapse in upon itself.
Oh, yes, I agree. Yeah, yeah. Because there's certainly points in it where it's just very... I don't really get Drew Starkey as an actor. I don't think that he brings all that much here other than attempting to look good and fine, but I don't get much of the allure from his character other than he is a physical being that's supposed to look good. There is the physicality of the film as well, which kind of will lead us into talking about Baby Girl in a moment. But I think that the physicality of seeing somebody like Daniel Craig so eager to embrace sexuality on screen and just throw himself into a very open shots, and the styling of it as well is it's just fascinating. And I've listened to a fair few conversations about the film lately, and he's really enjoyed that kind of vulnerability on screen and being able to show that he can do this kind of stuff. It makes me fear for the next actor that gets trapped in the James Bond cycle, because they seem to really manufacture and hold you into a style of film that you're only allowed to make. And I'm hoping that now he's got this under his belt that we're able to actually get some more of these kinds of great performances, because I've always felt that Craig has been one of the great actors and has just not had the ability to really show it off in the way that he should be able to. Which I guess leads on to, if we want to talk about Baby Girl next, would be good.
Yeah, I just wanted to say too about Drew Starkey's character. Jack Kerouac said of Addleton that it was one of the great tragedies in life that William Burroughs fell in love with such an ordinary and undistinguished and distant, like uninteresting man. So,
So the deliberate choice of Starkey as being somebody who is uninteresting then feels sexual. It's interesting then. I would never have thought of that, but there's not much to him, which I get then. I guess let's start talking about Harris Dickinson, because he's the equal of sorts in Baby Girl. And he's also somebody who I kind of felt was a little bit of nothing, but he has a lot more going on under his eyes than Drew Starkey does. I'm not really all that familiar with Harris Dickinson's work. With that said, I have seen The Iron Claw. Having a look at the previous films he's done, I'm one of those terrible people. I still haven't seen Triangle of Sadness, or Scrapper, or Beach Rat. So I'm quite deficient in those regards. But I have seen The Iron Claw. I have seen Baby Girl, and he's phenomenal in both of those films. But he's one of those people who does have that that appearance of not really having a lot going on, but there's a huge amount going on in his eyes, and he does a lot with a blank face in Baby Girl, which really gives Nicole Kidman a lot to work from. What did you feel of Harris Dickinson in this film?
Well, I quite like Harris. I especially enjoyed him in Beach Rats. I love Eliza Hittman, so you know that's just a given. And he's also been in a Xavier Dolan film. Like he's done quite a bit. I think here one of the great things about his performance is that he is actually quite scared of himself. Samuel is scared of the power that he has, that he can read people so easily, and he is, in effect, a genius. And he can make people do whatever he wants. He just has to kind of work out whether he ethically and morally can do it. And it's not a question about morals in the film, but more so about whether you use your power. So Nicole Kidman's Romy, for example, you know, high paid executive, isn't in a bad marriage with Jacob, but at the same time hasn't been able in 19 years to talk about what she actually wants out of sex. And so when she meets Samuel, who is, let's face it, badly dressed, like he is.
He is. Yeah.
Dressed. He is deniably unsexy until he's sexy. If that makes sense.
It does, because he manages to own that shagginess in a way, the unkempt nature. And, you know, it's interesting you talk about how it is about the use of power. And I find this film absolutely fascinating in the way that it doesn't really engage with the conversation about male power directly, but it does actually comment on it in a lot of different ways, in the sense that how men in the workplace are just kind of comfortably able to just, you know, skate on upwards, basically. And there is a conversation that is had later on with Sophie Wilde in the film, who is absolutely phenomenal, and as is Antonio Banderas. I think the supporting cast here is just great. But there is that conversation of how easily men just kind of skate upwards. And yet there seems to be an awareness of that from Samuel, from himself, of like, how am I safely using this? This seems like a consensual relationship with Romy. Is this something that is right? We don't ever hear that from him, but that's what I get from Harris Dickinson as an actor, is this questioning about his character's role in utilizing power, in being able to say, I'm comfortably putting myself forward here and using or taking advantage of, or comfortably having a relationship with a CEO. Like that's really quite a fascinating thing to explore, and especially kind of a timely thing. It is a conversation that happens a lot outside of film and stuff, so to be able to have it explored in this way, was that something you found at all in the film?
I did, but I mean, Samuel's a very interesting character, because he says to Romy several times, I feel like you're using me to burn down your life, and I'm not comfortable with that. I don't like having that power. But at the same time, when she refuses to do things, he says, I'm going to go to HR. I have the power here. So there is this consistent swapping of who has control. And I don't think either of them have control. It's a stalemate, which is what becomes it fascinating, because as soon as he starts crossing streams, as soon as he starts coming into her family life in any way, even if it's part of his job, she freaks out. And she's also saying, I don't want to hurt you. I don't want to hurt you. And there's a scene which we won't go into deeply, where they're almost reconciling kind of where they're at, and they're interrupted, and they have reached a consensus of what happened between them. And they both kind of recognized that they damaged and uplifted each other. And, you know, I just think it's fascinating. And yes, Sophie Wilde's character, Esme, also uses power and control to get what she wants in the film. And then you have the character played by Victor Slezak, which is, you know, just perfect for who he is, who comes in to Romy and says, you know, I know what you did, so you're coming around to my house to entertain me. And she's like, do whatever you want, but also fuck off.
Yeah.
So it's a fascinating piece of work by Helena Wren, and I think that the complexities of it will be lost a little bit because it's just so horny as well. You know?
But it's one of those films, just like Queer, where over time, if people give themselves to it, then they'll be able to embrace and engage with that text. And I mean, I think this is the best performance Nicole Kidman's ever done. Like, I think that there is something that is seriously phenomenal here of just this understanding of, while it's never commented on within the film, there is this meta-textual sense of one of her most iconic films, of course, is Eyes Wide Shut, equally a film about sex, equally a film set at Christmas time, about somebody who we now know is a very controlling person, Tom Cruise. And so part of me does wonder if the reason why Nicole is so eager to give herself to this is to finally exercise those demons. It's, I mean, 19 years, that was 25 years ago, of course, but 19 years, 25 years, it's kind of close. And there's this sense of being restrained and not being able to talk about what has happened in the past for her. And I feel, and again, this is just pure conjecture, there is nothing in the media or anything about it, but I feel that there is a sense of Nicole finally being able to explore that traumatic period through a film like this, and through, you know, having a good relationship with somebody like Keith Urban, which is quite clearly somebody who she's feels comfortable and free with. And I feel I might be reading a little bit too much into that, but it's those kinds of things that when you sit down and you watch a film and you engage with it on those kinds of levels, you do read into things that way. And maybe people might do that a little bit more with Baby Girl as they spend more time with it and, you know, the discussion pieces come out and all this kind of stuff. But it is a film that really opens itself up to that kind of exploration. And I think that is the benefit of having a great director like Helena, who I think is just really turning into one of the more interesting filmmakers in the moment. She's really done some fascinating stuff with Baby Girl. And she did Bodies, 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 didn't she? Yeah, and Bodies, Bodies, yeah. Bodies as well. Yeah, so both of those films.
She did one in Dutch, which I haven't seen. Mm. She's Dutch, but I just haven't had a chance to see it. But
and of course, she's an actress too. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. One thing that I was particularly interested in is because as soon as I watched Baby Girl, I immediately put on Secretary, because we're dealing with a similar idea, but the age difference, of course, is, you know, Maggie Gyllenhaal is young, James Spader is old. And it's about these two also coming to terms with how they're going to express their desire for each other. And what I found interesting is the director of Secretary, Stephen Schoenberg, is also the director of Fur.
I was going to say, yes.
Imagining portrait of Diane Arbus, where Nicole also gets her freak on, this time with Robert Downey Jr. So, there's, again, Venn diagrams.
Well, Fur was going to be the film, the older film that I was going to recommend people seek out. I haven't seen it since it first came out. I remember appreciating it then. I'm not sure if it's really holds up all that well, but the duality of Nicole and Robert in that film, Robert Downey Jr., is something that I think is quite fascinating. And you mentioned, of course, Secretary, and Steven Sheinberg does a very good job of exploring those boundaries. And Fur, I think, is a film that is maybe underappreciated in Nicole's career, but she's fascinating in that particular film, and the way that she both physically and emotionally exposes herself to the audience, which she does time and time again in different films. I think it's a fascinating film. I might rewatch it soon.
Yes, I definitely will. And we will do a short podcast on it. We will talk about it. We'll come across these. A quick sum up. If you were going to give Queer a score out of 5, what would it be?
Well, I'd give Queer a 3, with the notion that it would be, you know, something that I might kind of, again, in the future, revisit. I think that it would grow in my estimation, but that's 5 or 6 years away, if I remember. Yeah.
I would give Queer 3.5 stars because it has some transcendent sequences, especially the Aisha scene where they're touching without touching. That's gorgeous. With Baby Girl, that's a straight up 4 out of 5 for me. When I first watched it, I was not in a good mood, and I was like, nah, I don't want this. And then I rewatched it because I knew it was my mood. I knew it wasn't the film's fault, and saw exactly what it was doing. I mean, even her company is called Tensile. It's about, you know, there are all these in jokes going on that are just so well written by Helena. So I would say that it's a very sexy 4 out of 5 and a fascinating meditation on power and the willing to give up power and take it.
Yeah. And I give it 4.5 out of 5. I think it's one of my favorite films that I've seen this year. I just love it to bits. But you're talking about the giving up of power, and this is something that I've always found really interesting about Nicole as an actor, and certainly as a creative person too, is that she quite willingly uses her power to bring emerging Australian actors into the fold, like she does with Sophie Wilde. And, you know, Sophie's just going on and on and on. She's going to be a huge star. She already is. But it's really nice to see Nicole actually being aware that she has that kind of power and that ability to bring people in and support them. So it's wonderful. Yeah.
Even her psychiatrist who is essentially a program is voiced by Dolly Wells. So there's this, you know, there are a whole bunch of fascinating creators within it.
The snow was falling, falling faintly through the universe, and faintly falling on all the living and the dead.
I will not go out in mortifying anguish.
I don't know what to say.
I'm hoping you'll say yes.
Yes to what?
Anyone who is a fan of queer cinema or films about mothers or Spain in general has come across Pedro Almodóvar in their life. Pedro has done his first feature film in English. He's done 2 shorts, one with Tilda and also the A Strange Way of Life with
Pedro and Ethan
as very well dressed gay cowboys, because everyone's very well dressed in a Pedro film. And all the sets are lovely. I struggled with this one. And the reason I struggled with this one is that it's hard to hear his dialogue transposed into English, because it is deliberately stagey and there's this sort of telenovela style to it that as an English speaker, I didn't pick up when I was watching the Spanish films because I was watching them with subtitles. But now I'm watching both Julianne Moore and Tilda Swinton say the words out loud and John Turturro. It just seemed overtly melodramatic.
And not in a way that is easy to penetrate. I should add, I've watched the first half hour of this and then I bounced off it for that exact reason. And I had said to myself that I would revisit, but I watched The Beekeeper instead. So there you go.
So you went for some Statham. So, you know, from the sublime to the whatever. Okay, so the story is about two friends who knew each other in back when they first started working. They're both journalists and they shared a lover who was John Turturro, who is now an academic working on climate change. Martha became a photojournalist and went into war zones. She has terminal cancer. Ingrid is signing books in what I guess is New York or Boston, but it's really just Spain. So it's New York because I think they go to Upper New York. They do. They go to Woodstock, which is also Spain, in the film. Ingrid has an unbearable fear of death. Absolutely, you know, it plagues her, and she finds out Martha is dying. She has terminal cancer, and Martha has decided that she's going to end her life on her own terms, and asks Ingrid, after asking several other people, she wasn't Martha's first choice, if she will stay with her in Woodstock and be in the room next door with her when she dies, when she'll close the door. And so Ingrid can't be implicated in euthanasia, but she just wants someone next to her. And so these two women go through both their past relationships with each other, their own pasts, and, you know, discuss the things that make life worth living. A really nice idea, not well executed, in my opinion. And as much as I enjoy, you know, looking at Pedro's expensive furnishings and his lovely coffee machines and beautiful lamps and his primary colors, it just fell flat for me. And I do like his work, so yes, this one just doesn't work for me. I mean, especially when you've had something like Parallel Mothers just before it, and Pain and Glory, and, you know, all these legitimate masterpieces. It's a slight letdown. And Tilda was saying, you know, that his English is still quite rudimentary. But I imagine, seeing she speaks 97,000 languages, her Spanish is quite good.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I would like to see her. And I, in interviews that she's done, she has talked about wanting to be part of one of his films in Spanish language. So she has that versatility. I can only hope that's the case. Probably less so for Julianne Moore. I'm not sure how well Spanish would go from Julianne Moore's perspective, but as great an actress as she is, it's Tilda who is the versatile one and it appears to be the one that's getting all the praise for this particular film. It is a shame that it didn't translate as well to English as initially hoped, but nonetheless, like, from the perspective at least that I had from that short half hour that I watched, even though I didn't sit through the whole entire film, it is clear that a failure for Pedro Almodovar would be a win for almost anybody else. So, like, it's not an outwardly terrible film. It's just his level is so high that when he has to stumble like this, that, you know, it's kind of forgivable. Like, you can't be at a peak all the time, even when you shift over to English language. Like, it's just not possible. But it seems like an interesting experiment nonetheless.
I don't think it's a complete failure of a film. In fact, I think it's relatively enjoyable on its own terms, in that, you know, it's still Pedro. You know, he's still a great director. I just think that if we're going to look over his oeuvre, it's one of his lesser films. And as you said, you know, a lesser film by someone like Pedro is still a better film than most people will ever make in their lives.
Yes. Yeah.
And just a note, we have connections here. We have a connection that Esther McGregor, who plays Nicole Kidman's daughter in Baby Girl, plays a young version of Tilda Swinton in The Room Next Door. And once again, Tilda Swinton comes back and plays her own daughter.
Yeah, it seems to be something she likes to do. So good on you, Tilda. Good on you.
Yeah. Yeah. So yes, I like Venn diagramming the entire world.
Yes. Now, as we lead into wrapping up, do you have an older film that you would want to kind of recommend people seek out in the meantime?
Back to the podcast, my recommendation, tying up both Daniel Craig and Tilda Swinton, is Love is the Devil, a study for a portrait of Francis Bacon by John Mabry, who was a close friend of Derek Jarman's. And as you know, Derek Jarman was a director who had Tilda in almost everything he ever did. And so we have Daniel Craig playing George Dyer, the particularly sadistic lover of Derek Jacobi's Francis Bacon, and Tilda Swinton playing Muriel Belcher, who is kind of a drunken pub society hostess. Like, they all hang out in this pub and she yells at people and she's fantastic. So I would have people seek that out if possible. That would be my recommendation. So my score for The Room Next Door is 3 out of 5. A lesser Pedro film is still generally a good film. I just think that he needs to work a little bit more on naturalistic language if he's going to go into English language films.
Yes. Yeah. And if you're interested in seeing The Room Next Door, it is currently in cinemas right now. And in Australia, Queer has a release date of the 6th of February, and Baby Girl has a release date of the 30th of January. So make sure to head along and go and see those films in a cinema. I know I'll be going to see Baby Girl again in the cinema because I absolutely loved it, as you've just heard. And please make sure to subscribe to the podcast on whatever podcatcher you use, or alternatively, just listen to it directly from the website at thecurb.com.au, where you can also listen to other interviews and discussions that will pop up throughout the year. Thank you again, Nadine, for this conversation. It's been wonderful. Make sure to tune in again, as I just mentioned, to our next episode, which will not be very far away. We will see you all on the next one.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you, everyone.
You seem liberated.
I've never experienced anything like this.